Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Davey Wanton, and he'll be answering your most important questions on wet fly techniques for big trout. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Davey a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Davey Wanton about wet fly techniques for big trout. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Davey, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered for the drawing yet, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for that link under Davey's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. And thanks to Davey, we're also going to be giving away a copy of his DVD called Wet Fly Ways. After you listen to this show tonight, you're going to want that DVD, I guarantee you, because it really is going to go into way more detail than we can on the show tonight. And, of course, the visuals are something that we just can't do on a radio show. But anyway, we're going to be giving Wet Fly Ways, a DVD, away tonight. And to win, you have to be the first person to answer the question that we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be about something that Davey and I talk about during the show. So you're going to answer that on our homepage in that text box on the homepage where you'll be able to also ask questions during the show. That's where you'll be able to also answer this question that we ask. And the first person that gets it correct and puts in their name and their location will win that DVD. So good luck with that, and listen closely tonight. Davey Wanton's interest in fly fishing started way back in the 50s when he watched his first trout caught by a fly fisherman. To say he was hooked was an understatement. His professional career began in the early 1960s as a professional fly tier, moved on to manage a mail-order business developing and manufacturing both fly tying and fly fishing products, one of which was the world-famed SLF series of dubbings. He began writing the fly fishing articles in the early 70s and continues to do so. Many of his fly patterns are currently produced commercially for the world market. He is a consultant to many of the fly fishing organizations around the world. This past 5 years, working in conjunction with Fly Fish TV, has produced a number of shows for national networks, along with his own series of how-to DVDs. Wet Fly Waves has had great success with 2 neat DVDs to be released this year, Davey's Favorite Flies and the White River. This past August, he shot a further DVD related to stillwater fly fishing techniques in Montana. Davey was recently awarded in Atlanta the USFW Director of Fisheries Award for Outstanding Voluntary Services Towards Fisheries and Conservation for Services Rendered. He is a popular speaker at fly fishing events around the country and hosts many other fly fishing activities during the year. He will tell you that there is no finer place to be than on the water fishing, and despite his professional workload, he still finds time to do that. His credits for the White River amount to catching a brown trout, 25 pound, 6 ounces, a cutthroat at 6 pound, 4 ounces, a rainbow at 8 pound, 2 ounces, and a brook trout at 2 pound, 12 ounces. That's quite a resume there, Davey. So welcome, and hopefully you'll share some secrets with us tonight.
Yeah, Thank you, Roger. Pleasure to be back here again.
Now, have you beat any of those records?
No, not yet. the closest I came to was about six weeks ago, was a rainbow that was about a 7.25 pound, but here on the White River system, but and not even close with a brown trout like that, you know. That's a once-in-a-lifetime fish, you know.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I haven't caught one that big, so it's not even a once-in-a-lifetime fish.
How many times do you go fishing for them?
Yeah, that's it. And the right way to do it, too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Let's get started, and we're going to... a lot of people, I don't think, are really familiar with wet fly fishing, at least in the traditional sense, and that's what you know best. And So let's dig in and see what we can learn and teach, and we've got lots to talk about. Lots of great questions from you folks again tonight. Feel free, like we said, too, to submit additional questions during the show, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can. Okay, first of all, we've got Robert in Atlanta, Georgia, and he says, I'm new to fly fishing. Could you please describe what a wet fly is and the difference between a wet fly and a nymph? And maybe that will kind of lead us into what is wet fly fishing?
Yeah. Okay. You know, that's not necessarily an easy answer, to be honest about it, because a fly that sinks below the surface other than a dry fly, by definition, is a wet fly. But for those of us that fish by what we term as the traditional wet fly means or methods or techniques, a wet fly is a fly that is constructed in a certain way. And that could be a winged wet fly, to all intents and purposes, you know, a North Country spider hackle fly is a wet fly, or a soft hackle is a wet fly. A nymph to me is a nymph, and a streamer is a streamer in that sense of the word. So it's kind of a difficult question to answer other than the manner I've just given the answer to that. So my interpretation of what a wet fly is a fly that's got some traditional structural value to some historical background of the period of time and or where it was, shall we say, innovated as a fly or the technique of fishing those flies was practiced, which differs significantly from, by and large, nymph fishing.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but nymph fishing, tying nymphs are generally more...
That's right. I was just going to add that. By definition, nymphs are generally impressionistic designs of invertebrate food sources, whether they be mayflies. Of course, in the case of caddis, they're not nymphs. They're pupa or larva. Whereas wet flies are not directly tied to represent anatomically a food source that those fish would generally see. However, by definition of the character, shape, size, color, and all the other variables, fish eat them. What the fish sees when it takes those, I can't answer you that. Only a fish can give you the answer. So, in that sense of the word, you can actually use wet flies in place of nymphs. So that's the way to try and explain that to a robber. That, say, for example, we had an emergence of caddis, then there are a lot of wet fly patterns and soft tackle patterns which are as good, if not more so effective, at times when the fish are actually taking a caddis pupa in the stages of its emergence and or when it's ascending from the bed of the river to the surface. And more to the point also when the winged insect has emerged. So you have wet flies and soft tackle to some extent that you can use to copy those bugs, because the means and methods of fishing those flies would differ to a large extent to how you would fish, for example, a caddis pupa in the stages of emergence and or as a winged insect. One of the fascinations of this style of fishing.
Yeah, I know you're going to get into how this all comes together later on, and people will get a better idea of the difference in the way it's fished, and also the variety of flies that you're fishing at one time, during, like you say, maybe a hatch or something. Well, where did wet fly fishing originate?
Well, you know what? I cannot answer you that question, other than the fact that if you go back historically to what I would define more as relevant historical literature, then you're looking at something in the region of the past 400 years. I don't know, you know, what happened 500, 600, 700, 800, 900 years ago, because there was little literature written about that. But I would add, I would believe this, that any, shall we say, structure that was made from fur or feather at that time would have sunk. So by definition, lot longer than 400 years.
But the wet fly techniques themselves, as you teach them and as you fish them today, you primarily come from United Kingdom, don't they, or
yes,
Europe?
Yes, they
than
do.
The US. Yeah.
Although wet fly fishing, in that sense of the word, also was practiced in other parts of Europe. But as you probably know, by and large, the bulk of fly fishing literature historically is really from around the 1750s, based from what was written in the United Kingdom. Albeit, techniques of fly fishing were practiced elsewhere. But little was ever known about that, and that's still largely true today to some extent.
And how did you get started in wet fly fishing? Is that how you started? Is that the first
thing
you
remember? Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, okay.
When you gave the introduction there, the first time I ever saw a person fly fishing was in the 1950s, and he was fly fishing on a river system that ran through some of our family's farmland property. And this old guy would come down there. He had a bamboo rod at the time, I know that. And that's what he would do. He would go out in that stream, and he would fish with, you know, I honestly can't remember whether it was 2, 3, or 4 flies, but it was more than one, that I know. And he would catch these wild browns. And he would take them home and he'd eat them. So that was the first time I ever saw that style of fishing practiced. And of course, bear in mind too, at that point of time, what people know of understanding today, well, none of that existed like it does. The dry fly fishing obviously did have some practice at the time, but, you know, fishing with indicators as they people commonly do today and various other things, it didn't happen because, for lots of reasons, the knowledge wasn't there, and furthermore, they really didn't have the equipment to enable them to do it in those days as they do today. So that was my first introduction, and he was, in fact, the first person to ever show me how to cast a fly rod and catch a fish on a wet fly, which was an Alexander, by the way.
Which was in Alexander, is that what you said?
No, was caught on, it was a fly.
Oh, on an Alexander, okay.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
I didn't hear what you said, yeah.
No problem.
And you still remember that? Wow. Must have made quite an impression.
Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of things I've did in my life in my world of fly fishing and hunting that I would never, ever forget those. In fact, I can still picture in my mind exactly where I was at that time and where I caught that fish. In fact, I could go back there today and show you exactly where that was. That's assuming the river's... Well, I know the river's still there, so that's... Yeah.
And that was in Wales?
No, it was in Devon, Devonshire.
Okay.
Yeah, which is very west of London. It's a beautiful county, but that's kind of south across the Bristol Channel from Wales.
Oh, okay.
Dairy country.
Dairy country.
Yeah.
Is that like spring creeks there? Were they more spring creeks?
No, they're not. They're mostly freestone river systems.
They are.
To the best of my knowledge, there are no spring creek systems in the county of Devon. I might be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure they're not. Most of those rivers end up in the ocean, and consequently they have, by majority of them, Atlantic salmon running to those systems, sea trout, which are, of course, the anadromous strain of brown trout, and brown trout that live in them. And some of those little creeks, you call them creeks, they call them brooks or burns and stuff, you know, them brown trout don't grow much more than about 7 to 10 inches because they're acidic water environments and there's very little natural food base. And actually a wet fly in those kind of systems is probably without any question of a doubt the most productive way to catch those guys.
Well, good. Well, it gives us a little background about the wet flies. And we have Mark in Wellsville, New York.
Yes.
Do you know Mark?
I'm not sure what I've ever met Mark personally, but I know of him, yes.
Okay. Okay. He says, I've been a wet fly fisherman for many years and know how productive it is.
Yes.
Do you feel wet flies are once again growing in popularity?
Oh, yeah. No question of a doubt about it. As Mark probably knows, you know, historically here in the United States in the late 1800s, that pretty much was the manner in which most people fly fished until, you know, a number of individuals pioneered more so into the United States way of thought of fly fishing, other methods, which, of course, largely had their origination from the UK. And then, of course, I think, in all probability, even though there were a number of publications written in those times, most of which really illustrated the flies more so to teaching and the techniques of wet fly fishing, Probably Sylvester Neames, when he introduced his publications related to soft fish and soft hackles, got a certain amount of interest. There's no question of a doubt about that. But I don't believe even then that it was largely practiced as it is today. And, of course, as we all know, even with programs like yourself, you know, and other literature and whatever, you know, DVDs and videos, and there's much more public awareness of it. And so I have no doubt at all that, it's much more popular today. And it's growing in popularity, because I think a lot of anglers, they kind of got bored with the indicator bobber fishing style of technique, and wet fly fishing offers you absolutely totally different dimensions insofar as pursuing with a fly rod trout, because there are just many variables of what you can do, as you well know after seeing the Wet Fly Ways DVD.
Yes, and specifically it's contrary to a lot of techniques you learn as nymphing, and for instance contrary to dead drift, whereas a lot of times, as you'll explain later, you may not be doing a dead drift. You'll be doing other things. So,
right.
Yeah, so it's quite different. It requires a whole new mindset, I think.
I would tell you the easiest way that I could explain that would be this, is that wet fly fishing demands two things to happen primarily, and that is a relationship of what your rod or right hand is doing and your left hand. And because they both have to work in unison to effectively work a lot of the techniques that wet fly fishing deploys. And it doesn't matter what it's upstream dead drift, or it's, you know, it's what we call a quarter across downstream dead drift, or actually physically working those flies up through the water column so they emerge and imitate emergent insects and induce the fish to come up and take them. Absolutely. You know, I mean, by definition, generally when nymph fishing is concerned, as we know it, it's a dead drift technique where you aim to fish a fly in a manner of presentation that is, by and large, the way the fish, or you believe the fish would expect to see that natural food source, which for 90% of the time is on or near the bed of the river, with the exceptions of times when there is an emergence, where those food sources move from the bed of the river to the surface or crawl out on the shores to emerge as winged insects.
Well, let's talk a few minutes about flies and the insects. And the you mentioned earlier, you know, that there is not a real clear definition when you say wet fly. It can mean a lot of things. So, David, in Livermore, California, yes, are there any specific characteristics you look for in a wet fly? And maybe you can kind of, if you could, Davey, maybe break them down into groups of wet flies that you use, and then we can learn how to use those as we go on here.
I'd need about 10 hours to go through all that one. So, but let me just try and explain this to David. Wet flies, if you take wet flies by definition, there are primarily five characteristics of a wet fly, or components, which would be a tail, a body, a ribbon medium, a hackle, and a wing. Okay. Now, not all flies incorporate all of those five components. Now, if you take, for example, a North Country spider, well, essentially that's a thread body with very sparse wound hackle. It contains two of those elements. If you take, for example, a fly like the Invicta, that contains a tail, it contains a body, a dub body, it has a ribbon medium, it has a wing, it has a palmed hackle, which is wound from the eye down to the tail, reverse wrap with a ribbon tinsel, and in the case of that particular fly, also incorporates a throat hackle. On the other hand, you can have some of the more, what I call, exotic kind of wet flies. Take, for example, like a Parmachini Bell. That fly has a married wing. So it's a little tiny mini version, if you like, of a classic Atlantic salmon fly, because it's got color bars of, in that case of that fly, white and red for both tail and the wing. So, and then if you take a soft hackle fly, well, you know, soft hackles today are a little different by definition than what they were historically in the past. By definition, they tend to have a lot more material on them. So a soft hackle in itself could also incorporate tail filaments. It can incorporate a body and a ribbon medium. But in most cases, A soft tackle would not incorporate a wing, but it'd have a soft tackle wound at the head, either sparse or fairly full. So if that's the easiest way for me to try and explain that to you, David, that they are the main difference. But you ask me what are the specific characteristics that I look for in a wet fly. Well, the simple answer to that one is this, is the relationship with the fly, or name or pattern of that fly, to what it is I want to do with it at that time when I'm fishing. So, for example, if I was fishing a caddis emergence, then let me tell you, you know, there are traditional classic wet flies, an Invicta would absolutely be one of those, a silver Invicta would be another, a Wickham's Fancy, I'm just using three for example, that would equally work well during those circumstances. Then you can move on and say, well, a lot of soft hackles can also be as effective, if not more, depending. Like a greentail, which is just essentially a soft hackle, usually tied with partridge for the hackle, but there's other feathers that do it equally well, with a dubbed hair for a body, possibly with a gold or silver rib, but a green tag. So what causes me to make those selections is based on many, many years of experience, and just, I guess, I wouldn't say an absolute, but pretty damn close to an infinite knowledge of knowing by watching fish behavior what it is they're likely to eat in the manner in which I wish to present that fly.
Well, I know later on you're going to talk about the cast of flies. And
yeah.
That cast of flies represents what you just said, what you know about what they're feeding on and what's happening in the water.
Right? I think the thing that's confusing to people more than anything about that is this, if the truth of the matter be known, is that in many cases, wet flies as such, in that sense, don't necessarily imitate the food source that a fish are feeding on. But there is something about the characteristic of that fly, which is based on, of course, its size and its color, and very much more so the manner in which you fish it, the manner in which you make that fly present itself to that fish's eye, that triggers the response from that fish. Because other than dead drift techniques, and primarily you use more spiders and soft tackles for that, although I will add that upstream dead drift techniques and or across with wing wet flies can also be absolutely deadly. Those fish see something in those flies that triggers their response. Whether or not they see that from a perspective of being aggressive or a natural food source, I can't honestly give you the 100% answer, other than the fact I know that by the means that a fish takes the fly, it somewhat tells you whether it's taken it because it believes it to be a natural food source or it's taking it out of aggression.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, we need to take a quick break here, Davey, but when we return, we'll be talking with Davey more about wet fly techniques for big trout.
Hmm.
Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known guide, female guide, Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net, or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Davey Wanton about wet fly techniques for big trout. If you'd like to ask Davey a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. Well, Davey, before we continue on, I know you're very busy in a lot of different ways, and we mentioned a few of your DVDs, but tell us what you've been working on, and tell us a bit about your business, and, of course, be sure to mention your website so people can learn more about you and your products.
Sure. Okay. Well, since I was on the show last, I have been given the honor position as the chairman of the National Fisheries Friends Partnership in Washington, D.C., which, of course, is associated with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. And I was very happy about that because, historically, you know, back since the U.S. Fish Commission, they've been very much largely responsible for the introductions of fish around the country. I'm not saying in all cases they should have done that, but they learn lessons, let's put it like that. But the fact of the matter is, like it or not, you know, the fact that we now have the resources of trout and or other species for that matter we can fly fish for very much had a lot to do with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. So anyway, that was an honor for me. And anyway, on my recent annual trip to Montana, we filmed a four-hour video on the techniques of tying wet flies, spiders, and soft tackles. And, you know, I really didn't get all I wanted to get done on that, but I can assure you there's just a ton and ton of information there with technique of tying all of the five elements, essentially, that relate to tying wet flies, soft tackles, and spiders. And I actually also done another one because Gene, the guy that does a lot of the film work with me, wanted to get a new DVD out there on for beginners, and I think that's good. You know, I know there's a lot of books out there, but and I know how difficult it is. You know, when I teach people, it's very difficult, I mean, unless they got a very thorough comprehension of just the simple basics of even wrapping a good thread base on a hook. You know, how do you do it? Well, you know, there's easy ways to do that without janging the hook thread on the point of the hook and things like that, you know. So we did that. And then, of course, we went fishing, had a good time, hang out with a bunch of friends, and I always enjoyed out there, to be honest about it. And then I was honored again this Saturday. I was presented by the Federation of Fly Fishers an award, which is, I believe, it's the first of its kind they've ever given, which was for the Innovator of the Year Award, and they gave that to me, I guess, for all the things I'd done in the fly fishing business and one thing and the other, so I was again honored to get that one.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
A couple of awards, that's really nice. I know you work hard for it, so well deserved. And you said the DVD on fly tying will probably be out, what, 2010 sometime? Is that
That's right, yeah.
Okay. So, folks, you might want to look at Davey's website for that upcoming DVD, go along with the Wet Flies DVD. Probably make a nice marriage there of the two of them, huh?
Yeah, you know what? In retrospect, we should have actually did that at the time, but we had a whole lot of other things going on, and time was of the essence as far as that was concerned, and so we didn't get it done. But Wet Fly Ways DVD has done unbelievably, outstandingly well. And in fact, I know from Gene, it's absolutely the best number one DVD that he's ever produced in 12 years, I believe, something like that.
Well, there's certainly a lot to learn from that DVD. Well, Davey, what's your website address that so people can...
Oh, it's my name, DaveyWotton.com.
Okay, so DaveyWotton.com.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and so, folks, you can check out Davey's DVDs and also his guide service, and because you run a guide service still, right?
Yes, I own the American International Schools of Fly Fishing. I operate an outfitter guide service here in Arkansas. And as you know, I travel around the country doing programs for different fly fishing organizations, clubs, TU, federation clubs, and whatever. And actually, I supply a very, very large range of traditional wet flies because they're not easy to obtain in this country. And furthermore, you know, it takes a bit of technique to know how to tie some of those guys, too, as well. And I was telling somebody the other day, you know, the truth of the matter is unless you really love to sit down and tie flies, by the time you spend all the money on tying materials and this, that, and the other, then flies can work out pretty darn expensive. You're better off to buy them.
Yeah. I always wonder about that.
Oh, yeah.
But they are fun to tie, so, at least for some of us.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
The wiser ones probably never got involved and just buy them, and they get more fishing done, but... There's something about creating something on the vise and then taking it out the river and catching something with it. It's kind of the complete circle for me, anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we've got some questions specifically about flies. Jerry in New York wants to know, why not just take a dry fly and not put floating on it and fish it as a wet fly? Wouldn't it be the same thing? Or?
Well, you know, there are some wet flies, actually, that are pretty damn close, if you want to look at it like that, to a dry fly. And if you anointed them with a floating agent of some description, they would float on the surface. However, the general structure and caricature of a dry fly is somewhat different to that of a wet fly, a spider, or a soft tackle. There was a question, you know, that somebody asked, and Oh, I know. It was the first one, you know, the difference between a wet fly and a nymph. Well, I would add further that, you know, ultimately, a wet fly, as soon as it lands on the surface of the water, should sink.
No fooling around, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there was another question, too, that related to that, but, yeah, it should sink. And if it doesn't, well, there's obvious reasons why. I don't know if you want me to expand on that one right now or not, but, you know, there are things that you take into consideration, for example, weight of hook is one. You know, there's a big difference between a very, very fine wire and a heavy gauge wire hook. That's the first thing. And the nature of the materials you've tied on that fly. You know, if you're one of those guys that just wraps up a whole ton of dubbing on that body and it looks like a mouse, well, it ain't going to sink very fast, you know. So the nature of the materials that you use has to have, excuse me, some relationship to the fact that when the fly is cast on the surface of the water, it readily sinks. And that's another perspective insofar as determining what is a wet fly. Well, a wet fly to me is a fly that when it's cast on the water, it sinks. And if it doesn't, there's a reason why.
Yeah, yeah. Do you, another question, do you find any correlation between the size of wets you use and the size of trout you catch?
No, none at all. You know, I'm often asked that question. Well, you use big flies to catch big fish or this, that, and other? And the answer to that is, I never, absolutely not. I never make that consideration. None at all, never. Because I know from years of experience that huge trout will eat small flies. I mean, as you well know, this White River is just loaded with big, big brown trout. And you know what? Aside from the fact they'll eat 10-inch rainbows and they'll eat pretty much anything else they can gorge, they will still primarily gorge themselves on an abundance of sawbugs and scuds. Now, whether or not, you know, the intake of protein value enables them to grow as large, I don't know, but I would say if they had enough of them, it certainly would. So it's very possible to catch 10-pound-plus brown trout fishing very, very small flies.
Yeah.
And in fact, I would go so far as to say further that if you understand a lot of the techniques of fishing traditional wet flies, and bear in mind these flies almost all had their origination toward catching wild brown trout, because that's by and large where their origination is from, that's with brown trout, there was no rainbows. And if you work these flies in specific ways, you will induce a brown trout to take those flies, whether you trigger off his aggressive instinct or whatever, because they're that way anyway. Take, for example, a hopper. You know, a hopper gets blowed on the water, and he's jerking around. Boom, up comes this huge fish and eat him. Well, there was a reason why he done it. First of all, the hopper moving around on the surface water attracted his attention. Secondly, he recognized it was a worthwhile food source, because he ate it. He didn't spit it out. Well, you can do exactly the same thing with a wet fly. You can make that fly work on or off the surface to imitate a natural insect. It doesn't matter whether it's waterborne or terrestrial. And if you do it the right way and that brown trout sees it the right way, I can assure you he'll come up and he'll nail that so hard. You wouldn't believe it.
Okay.
So I've caught an awful lot of big brown trout fishing very, very small flies.
Okay. Question from Gary in Michigan. He asks, are there wet fly imitations for just about all the insects? And is there one specifically for the Hexagena that they have
okay.
up in Michigan?
Well, I think I already kind of answered that one, Gary, that most wet flies don't necessarily imitate anatomically a natural food source. There may be some relationship of coloration, size, shape, whatever the case may be, which differ, of course, when you tie a dry fly or a nymphal suggestion or something like that. And, of course, a hex is a very large mayfly. There's no question of a doubt about it. So you'd have to be using a pretty darn big wet fly to imitate that. You know, to my recollection, that there is some wet flies that have some relationship to that specific mayfly species. And if there isn't, I would be almost sure I could tie a fly that would do that. Well, in fact, I know I can, because we have a subspecies of Hexagena here in Arkansas, but it's not the Limbada like you guys get up there in the north. And it's about probably, oh, a little over maybe half the size. And I have patterns that wet fly patterns that work for that here. Tell him to email about that with me afterwards.
There you go. There
yeah.
you go, Gary. Martin in Lawrence, Kansas, he asked, is there, he said we were fishing the white last week, which is your neck of the woods down there, in higher water and had to wait the line for wet flies. What are some tips to building a better sinking fly? Let's go back to material selection.
Well, I know, Martin, because the guys were all down here at the Federation Conclave we had here. Hi, Martin. I'll tell you what the answer to your problem is. Well, let's put it to you like this. And unless I watched what you were doing, it'd be difficult for me to make 100%, shall we say, assumption of what the problems were. But I think I already previously mentioned it may have something to do with the nature in which you tied those flies. But secondly, wet fly fishing is not all about necessarily using a dry line in that sense of the word. Frequently, I use lines that are intermediates and or dry lines that have very short sections of intermediate tips. You know, maybe 2 feet or 3 feet of clear intermediate tip. And what that does, that enables you to get those flies down. And I'm not sure how Martin was fishing, whether he was fishing across in a downstream technique or what, or he was fishing more upstream. I would suspect with the amount, he might be in that when we had the water shut down. I'm not sure. But anyway, there are other options of lines to use, not just a dry line. And there's times when you need to use those lines because you need to get the flies in deeper in the water column, either for dead drift techniques or for working those flies back up through that water column to induce those fish to either move to them before they exit the surface or just on the surface before they're away out of the fish's ability to do it. But I, like I said, unless I was there watching what you were doing, Martin, I can only assume that either the flies you tied were tied in such a way they didn't sink because of that, and or you were fishing very possibly across stream and fishing with a fast water pace, and just the means of downstream drift and control did not allow those flies to get sunk. They skated.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll come back and talk more about those fly lines because we had some other questions about that. But
okay.
To finish up with flies here, I know there are hundreds of flies out there about patterns and so forth. We got a couple of questions in here, and I'm going to kind of lump them together. Lee in Australia and Tori in Connecticut, and someone else asked, they're all asking, you know, what are your top 1, 2, 3 patterns, especially for larger trout? Are there any, or is that, do you go about it a totally different way?
No, I
could give you a top three?
I could give those guys an answer to that question.
Okay.
Probably, this is a species-orientated issue, too, to some extent. But in the case of brown trout, absolutely, no question of doubt, the number one winged wet fly that has probably caught me more larger brown trout than any other is the Silver Invicta, which is a version of the Invicta. The difference is that instead of having a body of yellow silver, it's a silver body. The rest of the fly is primarily the same. And that fly I would generally use in sizes between 12, 14, and 16. Now and again for a larger sea trout run, brownies, I might go up to a 6 or a size 8, but that's a slightly different thing. So that would be, if the way to explain it to you, my number one fly pattern overall for moving water systems and or still water systems for catching primarily larger brown trout. The next fly I would add on that list, insofar as a wing wet fly would be concerned, is without any question of a doubt a fly called the Invicta, which is the other version of that particular fly. And probably the third fly I would add, insofar as wing wet flies are concerned, it's probably a Wickham's Fancy, because that fly is equally as effective for brown trout and rainbow trout. The Silver Invicta will work at any time of the year. And there's a relationship, I might add here, between the times of the year that certain flies seem to work better. So in the early part of the year when you've got cold water environments, the fish are less active because the natural food base is not active. There are certain flies I tend to use more so then than I would in the mid-season when the water temperatures are warmer. There's a greater abundance of natural food source, whether it's waterborne or terrestrial. And vice versa, when you get towards the end of the season, when conditions start getting colder, invertebrate food sources become dormant. And the habits of the trout change too. So they're not generally now looking for flies or food sources in the upper layers of the water column because they know they ain't there anymore. They're looking for their food sources on or near the bed of the river. And that has a relationship to the flies that generally one would choose to fish, either by dead drift modes or by other techniques of fishing. So Silver Invicta, Invicta, and Wickham's Fancy. no question of a doubt, would be within my top three.
Top three, good. And what about, go ahead.
I was just going to say, but there would also be, additionally to that, certain soft hackle and or spider hackle patterns that I would also choose to use. Because wing wet flies differ to some extent in the manner you fish them as opposed to, say, soft hackles or spiders. Because they generally are fished in different ways.
Let's talk about that after we take this break.
Absolutely.
And get into some techniques about how you do fish these flies.
Yeah, sure.
When we return, we'll talk with Davey Moore about wet fly techniques for big trout. Pere Marquette River Lodge, a full-service Orvis-endorsed lodge, fly shop and guide service, is located on the banks of the historic Pere Marquette River in Baldwin, Michigan. They provide year-round lodging for the business or pleasure traveler, as well as a full-service fly shop and guided trips for steelhead, salmon, or large resident brown trout. For more information, visit them at www.pmlodge.com. That's pmlodge.com, or call them at 231-745-3972. That's 231-745-3972. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Davey Wanton about wet fly techniques for big trout. If you'd like to ask Davey a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Now, Davey, we are getting some questions in on the Internet, and before we move into techniques, one of the questions with Aaron in New Jersey was asking about night fishing, and I know you go at night for the big browns. Is there difference in flies that you use, or do you use wet fly techniques at night as well?
Absolutely, yeah. I learned a lot of those techniques way, way back, because primarily sea trout in our rivers in Wales are largely fish that you're only generally going to catch in the hours of diminished light, i.e. nighttime. They're extremely secretive creatures, and they hide up, and you don't ever see them in the day. Later on in the evenings, dusk and into the dark periods, they come out of their hidey holes and back up into the shallows of the tails of pools, and typically that's where you catch them. Or if they're fish that are just running off the ocean, you know, odds are you might get one of those to nail a fly. But wet flies, no question of a doubt, are extremely effective. And in fact, those three flies I previously mentioned before we took a break are three really good ones. But there's a whole host of others too, you know, that are black bias flies or claret valley bias colored flies. You know, you have to ask yourself, you know, why do you need all these different flies? Well, if you look at wet flies historically, I would say that, no question of a doubt, there are more varieties of wet fly patterns than any other fly pattern out there. What I mean by that is, as opposed to dry flies, nymphs or streamers, I mean there are literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, and some of them would be defined more as fancy flies, some of them are more defined more as deceivers or attractors, you know, so you can kind of classify them to some extent. However, you know, we don't know what a darn fish sees. That's it. You know, it's really based on experience that you know under certain prevailing conditions. The odds are, given previous years of experience, that if you use these flies, the odds are you'll get a fish to hit them. And if you're out there on a day and you're just getting nothing working for you, then you just got to figure stuff out. And it may be as simple as changing the position of those flies. So, for example, the fly you had on the top drop has moved to the tail, and that makes a difference. I know people think, well, how different does that make that much difference? But it can, because, you know, the flies fish at different depths in the water column, and the fish see them different ways. You know, maybe the fly on the tail, the fish are not looking up to it, they're looking at it. Whereas the fly that's on the top drop, they're looking up at it and not at it, in that sense of the word. So you order them around, and so the fly that's on the top is now being looked at in the water column as opposed to looked up at against the sky. And believe me, that can make a big difference at times. But you just got to figure it out. And again, it's an issue of experience that teaches you those things. But aside from that, as we all know, as much as we may think we know, there's times the fish will tell us otherwise.
Yeah, exactly.
I know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about equipment. Now, I know you have some preferences for rod and length. You want to talk about the importance of that?
Yeah, absolutely. First and foremost, my absolute preference for a rod for these styles of fishing is a long rod. And typically, there in the United Kingdom, long rods have always historically been used. I mean, at one time, as much as 15 or 16 feet. Well, you know, it ain't too comfortable to cast a 16-foot single-handed rod. And in fact, to be honest about it, they largely didn't do that. Saying that, the longer the rod that you can comfortably handle, the more you are able to control and work those flies. In other words, if you take the difference between, say, an 8-foot rod and a 10 or 11-foot rod, there's a big, big mark difference into how you can effectively work those flies. Now, you could give me an 8-foot rod, and I could still go out and catch fish with wet flies, but what I will tell you is I'm very much handicapped and restricted to what I can do because the rod length is the problem. Whereas a 10-foot or 11-foot rod enables me to do things that I could not do with a short rod. So, yes, long rods, 10-foot, 11-foot.
Okay.
Which have what we define more as a mid-flex action. The last thing you need is a fast-action rod for lots of different reasons. First and foremost, you can't animate those flies. If you have a mid-flex rod, which is, I wouldn't say soft, too soft, but it's certainly got a certain degree of good flexibility, you can, with a very, very small amount of movement, even tapping your finger on that butt of that rod, transmit a signal through that rod, which will transmit a signal through that fly line and it'll make that fly move in the water. In other words, you're not jerking the rod up and down with your hand to make that happen. You're making very, very subtle little twitches that you transmit to the tip of the rod, which transmits through to that fly line and animates that fly, which some of which I demonstrated in that DVD on wet flies. Secondly, you can fish easier with teams of flies if laws and rules and regulations allow you to do that. And typically I will fish with 3 flies and sometimes 4. If you have a mid-flex action rod, it enables you, if you cast correctly, to throw a wider loop. And the wider the loop is, the less likely you are to tangle those droppers. The last thing you want is a textbook casting stroke where the upper and lower leg of the fly line are within 2 feet of each other, and you've got a series of droppers hanging off a 4 or 5 inch length of line. That ain't a good deal. Furthermore, it enables you to mend the line, too, in different ways without disrupting, shall we say, the path or track of those flies. You know, if you typically watch a lot of people when they dead drift with an indicator, they make a mend, they jerk the indicator 3 feet. Well, if the indicator moves 3 feet, so does the fly. Inevitably, it jerks it way up out of the vision of the fish's eye. And that's the same thing with wet fly fishing. You know, there's a lot of techniques where you need to track those flies in a certain way and maintain the depth of those flies or relative angle that you're fishing those flies across or downstream, or upstream, whichever. It doesn't make no difference. And a long rod facilitates you to do that. So there are many, many reasons why there's benefits to using long rods. No question about that. A mid-flex action. And line weight, incidentally, I choose to use most of the time, on average, is a 5-weight.
Okay.
A lot of times I use a 4-weight. In fact, I use, if the rod's right, I'll use a 4-weight line on a 5-weight rod for lots of different reasons. The lighter the line, the more animation you get with the flies. The heavier the line, the less. And it's like saying you the difference between an inch piece of rope and one that's 2 millimeters. Put them on the water and see which one moves more.
Yeah.
It's going to be the thin one. And that's the same with the fly line too, particularly for dry line techniques anyways. You get two things happen. First and foremost, you get way more benefits so far as making those flies animate. But secondly, you get superior take detection. Because unlike a lot of other techniques, the skill in fishing wet flies is to more or less instantly, if not, how would you put it, sixth sense, know the fish has got that fly. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that if you use heavy sunk lines, by and large, dry lines, as soon as that fish takes that fly, it's going to feel resistance. And he's more likely to spit that fly out quickly than he is if he takes that fly on a line that offers way less or little resistance. In other words, he can take the fly and move with it before he feels anything. By which point of time you'd have seen that, or you should have seen that fly line move, or you should have set the hook into the fish, not wait for it to hook itself. By which time, by majority-wise, you feel the fish prick it, boom, it's gone. And that's very common when you fish downstream, if you rely on waiting to feel the fish. because by the time you feel it, he's on a tight line, and he's in a position pretty much most times to spit that hook out.
Now, speaking of lines, you had mentioned before you were talking about changing up lines possibly in that deep water situation, I believe Martin was asking about. Tell us briefly here, you use both floating and sinking. Do you use sinking tip? And what about intermediate? What's the plan?
Yeah, okay. My first choice of line, obviously, is to fish a dry line. And I prefer double taper profiles. There's lots of reasons why I do. But primarily, a dry line gives you 100% control with the flies. That's the first thing. A sinking line doesn't give you 100% control, but you can get pretty darn close to it, depending on the technique you are deploying. Particularly if you're using the line for what we determine as anchor or hang weight. And I'll explain that very quickly. If you have, for example, adverse wind conditions, if you're trying to hold a dry line high off a high rod, well, the wind's going to jerk it around. It's not so easy to control your flies. If you use an intermediate line, well, of course, it's a heavier line. And a consequence of it creates what we call a hang because of the weight issue. And that enables you to have more direct control of the flies, even though you're not actually physically using that line, in that sense of the word, to control drift or drag. Otherwise, you're actually using it physically because of its weight. So dry line is my number one choice. On the other hand, there'll be certain conditions, and I mentioned earlier on, early season, late season, often when water temperatures are low, fish have no inclination whatsoever to come on close to the surface. And you need to get the flies to the fish in order for them to see it. A lot of steelhead fishermen tell you the same thing. And so I use primarily intermediate lines. And I prefer intermediate lines over sink tip lines, primarily, for lots of different reasons. And intermediate lines come in different IPSs, inches per second sink rates, for you guys that are not sure about that. And, of course, a clear intermediate may be 1 to 2 inches per second. Then you get 3 to 4, 5 to 6, 7 to 8. There are sometimes extreme times where I use way, way faster sinking lines than that, but generally not on moving water systems. They're mostly still water techniques more than anything else. And typically, too, when I fish with sinking lines, I'm generally not casting great ranges. My objective is to get those flies in the water column at fairly close range, which enables me a little bit more direct control. Because bear in mind, when you cast a fly line across the water and it's a sinking line, what does it do? It starts to sink. And once it starts to sink, you virtually have very, very little control. You can't mend the line. You're restricted by two things, primarily the rate of downstream drift and how you retrieve those flies back towards you, if indeed you do. Sink tip lines, the exception to that rule is dry lines that have got short sections of sink tip, and I think I previously mentioned that. And Rio actually makes some superb lines that fit that category. And there are 2 feet, 3 feet, and 4 feet of short section sink tip. But ultimately, you have the same control as you do with a dry line, with the exception of the fact that that short section of sink tip will get your flies down deeper in the water column and, shall we say, help you out in certain circumstances when you're dealing with adverse winds and various things. There's nothing worse than an adverse wind, upstream or downstream.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? If it blows upstream, it retards the drift of the flies down, and if it blows downstream, it whips them down there too fast. Plus, you've got the issues of mending. Whereas if you've got that short section of sink tip, it allows you to get those flies down deeper and gives you a little bit more direct control over what you're doing with them.
Yeah.
And there was one, let me just quickly back up here, Roger, on what Martin was saying to me regarding why his flies didn't sink, and I absolutely forgot to mention this factor. There has to be a relationship with the size and nature of the fly to the diameter of the line that you're using. In other words, if I was fishing, say, for example, 14s and 16s, winged wet flies, soft tackles, whatever, I'm probably going to be fishing 5X, and at many times I might even go down to 6X. Whereas if you was to fish those flies on 4X, given downstream speed and drift of water, it might not sink so fast. And also the other issue, are you using fluorocarbon, regular mono, or copolymer? They all differ.
Do you use fluorocarbon?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that, you know, there's a number of things I consider to be absolutely primarily beneficial for fly fishers today. And unquestionably, fluorocarbon is one of the major advantages that we have today, because it lessens us having to use other additional weight factors. I don't necessarily believe all the philosophies that go, well, it's less invisible and this, that, and other, but because I did a lot of tests with all different filaments in tanks and different light conditions, and all of which I can see with my eye. And I think a fish in his own water world has got a better perception than I do he's looking at what he's looking at. So, but aside from that, you know, I do believe, yes, fluorocarbons are very, very significant.
Why don't you detail out how you set up your leaders for wet fly fishing and incorporate describing the cast to fly so people understand what that is?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, in UK terminology, or historically, a cast of flies is essentially a leader system that is made up with typically two or three droppers. In other words, you have a tail fly, the one that's on the end, and you have two or three droppers with the flies affixed to them. And years ago, that fly fisherman would go to the fly shop, and he would buy a cast of flies, and they would be on gut at that time. And if he could afford it, they would actually be wrapped around what we call a cast connector. That's kind of a little circular thing with these little edges cut out, and it wound the cast around it so all the flies and everything didn't get tangled. And more to the point, it would enable the angler to just put that in water, because where gut was concerned, you had to soak it before you used it, because you couldn't just take it out and start using it. It's like wire. Well, the terminology for a cast of flies simply relates to that, that it's a set of flies that are set up on a rig. So if I refer to, as I do in my DVD, this is the cast of flies, what I'm saying is nothing to do with the physical act of physically casting. It is due to the fact that there are two or three or four flies tied up on a leader system to fish with. That's the cast of flies.
Okay, and then what is your normal configuration? Or I guess normal is always a relative term, but what's kind of a standard configuration you start out with?
Okay, there are a number of those that I used, and that, again, I have to tell you, depends on largely what it is or how I wish to present those flies. Am I presenting those flies in an upstream dead drift mode, across dead drift, or da da da? But to try and answer the question in simple terms, you can go one of two ways, and largely it has to do with your ability to cast those flies, to be honest. You can come directly off the fly line with 4-pound line, and set up a system of 10 or 12 feet in length with just 4-pound line straight away through. Or you can add to the fly line a short butt section, which may be 4 to 6 feet in length. Assume that you run that out there, whatever, say 10 pound. And to the end of that, what I do is I tie a very simple overhand knot. That's it. Simple overhand knot, pull it tight. What I then do above that simple overhand knot is I tie on the rest of the leader system, and I use my own, it's called a Davy fly knot. It's a very quick, simple system, a knot, and if you want to know how to tie it, just Google it, just look for Davy fly knot. And I tie that above that stop knot, and I just pull it down to that stop knot. And that, from that point onwards, it enables me to configure the rest of my system, which generally speaking amount to this, that droppers are spaced minimum of 20 inches. Usually mine are around 30 inches apart. So I have a tail fly, 30 inches up from that I have first dropper, and 30 inches up from that I have the top dropper. So we're looking at 5 feet, okay, from the top fly to the tail fly, and we may have something in the region of 4 to 6 feet of butt section that runs to that. So you may be ending up with an entire system of, or an average of about, where dry lines are concerned, I might hate it, from 10 to 15 feet. Now, where sinking line systems are concerned, that's different. I generally don't make long length configurations. If I want to work those top dropper flies, then, again, I have to tell you, it's again related to the prevailing conditions. I might want that top dropper fly, in extreme cases, 2 feet from the end of that fly line. Because the relative angle of hang of that fly line determines how you can work that dropper and at what range you can do it. On the other hand, I may want that dropper fly 6 feet away from the end of that fly line. But where sinking lines are concerned, and we refer generally to intermediates, generally, as a rule, my first fly is going to be around 4 feet from the end of that sinking line with the increments of between 20 to 30 inches for the droppers that come from that. And droppers, incidentally, are generally 4 to 5 inches. In fact, I rarely fish them ever less than about 4 inches for the simple reason they don't work, they don't animate real well. In fact, I've used top droppers before that are as much as 12 inches in length. And the reason I do that is because I'm using one or more flies below that are acting as my anchors, but my primary focus is to get the fish to come and take that top dropper fly by the means that I'm working that through in and out and off that surface film to induce those fish to come out and hit it. And it works equally as well on rivers as it does on still waters too, by the way.
Now, and when you're talking about, you had mentioned, and I know this from watching your video, but that top dropper, you said, it depends on how far, you know, away from the end fly and so forth. And that's because of the way that you're working that fly on the water, right?
Yes. And, you know, I might add this one too, Roger, that, you know, breaking strain of line, and it's always a question us guys get asked, you know, well, you know, are you happy to use 6X to catch big fish? Well, the answer to that question is yes, if I'm fishing a system that I have control over that fish. In other words, if I was fishing a rocky gorge and a river's running down there at 15 miles an hour, and, you know, that fish can pretty much tear off downstream from me and get yourself in a big, fast pocket of water, then I'm kind of nuts to use 6X line to do that with. And almost always in those kinds of circumstances, you don't need to fish 6X anyways. But if you're fishing, you know, slower flowing, medium flow rate systems, where you have little obstructions that fish hang you up on, no, I have no problem whatsoever to fish 6X. And in fact, the big brown trout I recently caught on the Madison was with a size 18 soft tackle. That fish was 60 feet across the far side of the stream and ate that fly on 6X. Well, yeah, you know, I had to dance up and down the stream after him, but so what? You know, the truth of the matter is you really got to analyze the situation at the time when you're fishing. Is this justifiable to use 6X in this kind of water system where I'm fishing? Yes or no? What's my odds of dealing with a good fish if I hook one? Good or bad or what? And if you think, well, it's not too good, then don't do it. Fish 5X or 4X, whichever. So always there, more so on the safety side. But I think a lot of that also has to do with angler skill. You know, some guys just don't have too much chance dealing with fish on 6X for one reason or the other. And other guys I know, they're well perfectly capable of dealing with fishing 6X, 5X, or 6X, and that's how it is. The equipment you use got a lot to do with that too, mate. You know, a fast, stiff action rod is not conducive when you're fishing 6X line. Whereas the kind of rods I use, as you know, mid-flex, soft-tip action rods, they can absorb a lot of that shock and kick that fish gives you. So, by and large, you know, you can get away with fishing lighter tippet sections. And I would add this, too, that the size of the fly I use has also a relationship to the breaking strain or diameter of line I use. I don't relate it to breaking strain, to be honest. I relate it to diameter.
Davey, quickly, explain how you tie in your droppers.
Oh,
so people understand,
you know,
that.
Okay. There are many different knots that you can use to effect droppers. And all I will argue is this, is that, and I've used them all, I've messed around with them all, and I've tried this and I've tried that, and you see all this scientific data. Yeah, well, you know, this knot is so-called 90% knot strength, and this one's 100% knot strength. You know what? All of that clinical, shall we say, data, in many respects, as far as I'm concerned, means nothing when you're on a river, because there are so many other issues that have to take in consideration. A, did you tie that knot right in the first place? Was the filament you used in good shape? You know, how did you set the hook on the fish? How much physical energy do you apply to the fish to try and land it? None of that can be incorporated into a scientific analogy of what the value of given knot strengths are. I mean, obviously, there are certain knots that are about totally worthless. And there are certain monofilaments out there today that certain knots work better with them than others. No question of doubt about that. But for my money, I'm absolutely comfortable to use the 3 or 4 turn surgeon's knot. And incidentally, where droppers are concerned, almost always you should use the dropper or the tag that is the one closest to the tail fly. In other words, if you are joining, shall we say, from your fly line, just say we're coming off there with 4X and we're going to join to it 6x, the tag for the dropper is going to be 4x, because that will be the lower of the tags when you've made that surgeon's knot. The 6x would be the upper face and the fly line, the 4x would be the one below the knot. And the reason you use that one is that you lessen the chances of it snapping, purely because the knot is not being pulled against itself, which would happen if you used the top dropper. Saying that, if, for example, you burned out your length of dropper, whatever, you tangled it up or you had to cut the fly off and you reduced it, you don't have to completely re-rig the system. All you do is you just tie above that stop knot, which essentially was what you formed when you made the surgeons, another dropper. And you do that by, again, I use my own knot, but you could use a clinch knot if you wanted. You tie that above that stop knot, which is what it now is, and essentially it just slides down to that knot, and there you are. You've got yourself a ready-made dropper, which can be of the same diameter of line that you previously used, or you can reduce it to tie a smaller fly. And you don't really have to, what I call, anchor that. You can if you want. You can just kind of take it back round below the knot and make a simple half hitch and it stops it sliding. But I will tell you from practice, the fact that it does that, forget it. Makes no difference. Because when you actually go through the process of casting and fishing, your fly will almost always be, or that knot will always be butted against the other. So in fact, that's how I used to do it years ago. Used to tie all my droppers like that. I didn't use the surgeon's knot because I didn't know how to do it. I used to join the line together. I can't remember why I used to do it now. That's a long time. And I would tie the droppers above. And
okay,
I know a lot of top-class wet fly fishers that do that.
Yeah, yeah. Davey, I want to get you into talking about presentations here. We have. So we're running out of time. That's why I'm cutting you off here. But I know there's many different presentations that you use, but maybe you could take the two that you use most often and kind of describe them, whether it's upstream or downstream or whatever, and kind of go through that in your retrieve. Spend about 5 minutes talking about each one of them so that people get an idea of how you're really working this cast of flies.
Yeah. Okay. The way I would approach a piece of water would be this, objectively. First and foremost, I don't want to spook the fish. So looking at it in that sense, the word fish that are upstream of me is almost always going to be determined by the fact, or shall we say, fishing for them is going to be determined by the fact that I'm going to fish an upstream cast presentation. What I mean by upstream is not a direct straight line upstream cast. I'm going to be in a position where I can present those flies so they track downstream across the stream. In other words, instead of, if you're looking directly upstream, say 12 o'clock, for example, the flies are all not directly in a line from 12 o'clock to my rod tip. What I'm going to do is present those flies so you're having the first fly, say, at the 2 o'clock position, and the other flies track back towards you across that stream. So when they track downstream to the fish, he has the opportunity to see one or more of those flies. And so do more than one fish, too, because often there's more than one fish in the same locality. Okay, that would be an absolute upstream dead drift technique, where once the flies have reached a position pretty much close to where I'm stood, I'm going to pick them up and represent them upstream. And in generally speaking, when I fish like that, my progress is going to be upstream. And typically I'm fishing flies that are representative of emergent food sources. And soft tackles are a primary fly for that use, and so are certain wet flies too, wing wet flies. Next option would be more of what we call an up and across presentation. That's where you would cast the flies directly more so across stream, more like 2 to 3, and you would dead drift track those flies for as long as you possibly can. And again, you facilitate your dead drift in the same way as you would a dry fly. You, in fact, men line up so the flies, again, track downstream. And you can finish that sequence by actually raising a rod and then working those flies up through the water column so they trip back towards you across the surface film. And it obviously will induce the fish, oftentimes, they'll come up and just grab those flies. If you watch that DVD, you would have seen some of that there when we were doing that. Then you've got more of an across-seam presentation. That's kind of like more directly at 3 o'clock position or slightly a little ways maybe down. Again, you affect a cast of flies across stream, and again, you can facilitate dead drift for an awful long time if you know how to do it before you reach a point where, of course, the flies are going to swing, which they will, and they're going to come across the stream back to the shoreline that you're fishing on. Now, you can do a number of things here. You can dead drift the flies for a certain period of time, And then at the point where you see movement of the flies, you can do one of two things. You can actually retard the drift of those flies or speed of movement by mending the line into the stream. In other words, if I'm casting upstream left side and the flies are moving downstream and they're coming back down to my right side, if I mend the line across the stream, it retards the speed and drift of those flies coming back towards my right-hand side, to that bank. If, on the other hand, I want to speed the flies up, then if I, shall we say, mend my fly line more close to the shoreline, my right side, well, of course, you create a large arc, which is essentially, when you're nymph fishing, not what you want to do, because it creates drag. Well, essentially, that's the same thing you're doing with those flies. You're creating drag that causes those flies to move across the stream back to the bank that you're fishing on, which at times can be quite deadly. The only downside of a lot of downstream technique is this. You will prick and lose a high percentage of those fish unless you're really, really good at practicing that art. Because, by and large, anglers, when they fish that way, rely on feeling for the fish. Boom, oh yeah, bam, big splash, bam, fish gone, bust off, all sorts. And the reason is because they're not watching the fly line. Or they're holding the rod in the wrong position. They're pointing the rod straight down the fly line. Nothing to absorb the shock when the fish takes. You've got to keep the rod at a relative angle, keep the line at a relative angle of hang, because that fly line has to move before you can feel it. It may be a fraction of a second or so, but believe me, once you get yourself tuned into that, you will hook a way, way higher percentage of fish, because you've set the hook in the fish before he's had the chance to really figure it and get rid of it.
What about when you're, like you said, after you come out of a dead drift, you use a certain retrieve to kind of dance the flies, so to speak.
Yeah, okay. I think I mentioned early on in the program that one of the skills of wet fly fishing is to have an absolute coordination of movement between both the rod hand and the left hand. And so I use a lot of techniques with my left hand, which are techniques of retrieve of line. The absolute number one technique I would urge any wet fly fisherman to learn is what we call a figure of eight. Some people call it a hand twist. It pretty much amounts to the same thing. What effectively you are doing is causing or bunching the fly line in your hand, your non-casting hand. And that allows you lots of different things. Absolute control of your flies, continuous smooth movements of those flies. You can release line from that coil of line. If you do it right, if you bunch it up and it's all wrapped around your fingers, that's not going to happen. You've got to keep that line absolutely perfect. If you watched on the DVD there, I can do it in a perfect circle. So I can release line, bring it back, do whatever I want. And it's a combination of rod movement with the right and the left of retrieving line and sometimes releasing slack line just to keep those flies working the way you want them to work to induce those fish to take them. And then we got what we call continuous retrieves, which may be actually very slight draws of the line. You may be drawing 6 inches or a foot or longer lengths of line like this, and you're holding it in coils in your hand until you retrieve the flies back before you recast again. So there's lots of combinations of retrieves which are imparted both by movements of the right and the left hand simultaneously or alternatively during that process of fishing those flies.
And when you're, like in the DVD, when you were doing a downstream presentation, you would cast out and then you would start to do that figure eight, bringing that line in, and then thereby dancing the top fly. Let's say we had three flies, top dropper, you're actually dancing on the surface of the water while the other two are subsurface, correct?
Yeah, that's kind of about right. Yes, that's exactly what you're doing.
And then with the slow retrieve, you're slowly working that up. So you're out of a dead drift, and you're actually playing with the flies and bringing them upstream, correct?
That is correct. What you're doing is by movement of those flies, you're inducing those fish to come up and take those flies. Because what probably may well have happened, you know, during the process of the dead drift, the fish have looked at them. You know, and that's how a natural insect progresses downstream before it emerges. It drifts downstream. But it also starts to ascend to the surface, and it pops out and emerges as a mayfly or a caddis or what. Well, what you try to emulate with a wet fly is exactly that. And that's about the way you go about to do that.
And I thought that was also when you're doing the figure eight or the looping technique. Are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, are you still there?
Yeah, we got some big storms moving in, but I think we'll be okay.
Okay, we only have a few minutes left here, so... what I was saying, with both those retrieves, the figure eight and the looping retrieve, you're maintaining all that fly line in your hand.
Yes.
None of it is going back on the water, so it's very easy for you to make that next cast and release that line.
Let me tell you, if there's one thing you need to learn with these techniques, is just don't drop the line on the water surface for lots of different reasons. First and foremost, when you go to pick up to make a recast, well, you know what? 10 or 20 feet of line dragging downstream, don't pick up off the water in a hurry. And the more you have that controlled in your hand, the less you experience those difficulties. And furthermore, fly line wrapped around your feet and, you know, structure on the river is not good to start with, because you guarantee one day you're going to hook you a big old fish and he's going to tear off in a hurry, and guess what? Boom, gone. The fly line fouled up.
Yeah, exactly.
Learn to use your hand to control your fly line. And it's really not that difficult when you practice. I tell people to do this. Don't, you know, there's plenty of time you have at home when you're watching TV to learn those techniques of retrieve. And all you need is the butt of the rod with the first guide, put the reel on the rod, strip the line up, put it up through the top guide, about 10 or 15 feet of line, and then go through the process of learning how to retrieve that line in your left hand, either with combinations of using your right hand, index finger or whatever, to control it under tension or whatever, before you go fishing. Because when you go out in that river to go fishing, you're going to be thinking about fishing, not, oh, that's business. You'll give it up in a hurry. I know you will. I've watched people do it. Oh, no, I'm going to fish, you know. They call all this line wrapped around their fingers. And it's don't come off real easy.
Well, to finish up here, we had a couple questions come in on the Internet, and I think it's kind of an important question. At least it's probably in the back of a lot of people's minds. And I'll read Jim's from West Virginia. He said, what prevailing conditions and insect activity would typically make you choose a wet fly presentation over nymphing as the most effective technique?
I can answer two answers to that question. Firstly, it would be this. By personal choice, that being the method I want to choose to fish for those fish. That's the first thing. But if I was fishing, as I did for many years, as a competitive fly fisherman, I'd have to make the choice to be the one which I know is probably going to be overall the absolute most effective. But I will say this, that there are few circumstances where you can't actually fish wet flies and do real good as you would fishing nymphs. Because bear in mind, you can fish soft hackles like nymphs, dead drift. It's not a practice I generally do, but that's not to say you can't. You can fish those flies with added weight if you need to. You can put a bead head on a soft tackle if you need to. You could fish two soft tackles on a droppers with added weight. So you can essentially fish soft tackles in the same manner as you can a nymph. However, bear in mind also, Roger, that we are fishing a lot of fisheries today where fish see an awful lot of human presence. They see pretty much every which way you can imagine the techniques and means we try to catch them. So they become educated, and they're not so gullible. And, you know, in many cases, a lot of the techniques that are generally not deployed are often way more effective, because every trout in that stream sees whatever it is, a pink sowbug come past it every day. It sees whatever, you know, anglers generally fish, zebra midges, da-da-da-da. You think they don't wise up to that? You bet they do. Go out there and fish something different. Fish a team of wet flies, soft tackles. Make those flies animate and work in ways that the fish are not used to seeing those flies. And I can assure you get it right. You'd be surprised what you'll catch when others are having a hard time fishing for those fish. But I also accept there's prevailing conditions that, you know, for example, if we're fishing a very fast, rocky stream and we need to get a big, heavy old stonefly near the bed of the river because that's what those fish are eating, then you're probably not going to get too close with that fishing with wet flies in that sense of the word.
Right. Yeah. Look at the activity. Look at the conditions. Figure out what the best approach is, and then go with what you're most comfortable with.
Yeah, that's right, too. You know, and to me, you know, given all my years at this game and, you know, Lord knows how many hundreds of thousands of fish I've caught, it doesn't matter to me anymore. You know, when I go out to fish, I fish the way I choose to because that gives me my pleasure. But at the same time, I also think a lot about what I'm doing. You know, just because I've done that 1,000 times before and I know it worked, well, why do I need to do it again to make it happen 1,001 times? Do something different. You know, you learn things by doing something different. You don't learn too much doing the same thing over and over again because you've experienced it and it's just really a repetitive exercise. Start to figure out stuff that you never done before. It doesn't matter, you know, whether you're using different flies or different techniques, but always go and fly fish with some basics of what I call understanding. You know, just it's not just go out there and chuck and chance it in that sense of the word, although fish still take flies when they chuck and chance, but have some logical approach to what you do. That's the easiest way I could explain that to you.
Well, that's a very good approach. Well, unfortunately, Davey, we're out of time, and we got to wrap things up here. But when we return, we're going to be giving away that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and Davey's DVD, Wet Fly Ways, which I know all of you will want to win tonight after hearing Davey and knowing that there's much more to be learned. So stick with us here and see if you win. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and a support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout, flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can help support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Well, just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners of our drawings are randomly selected from our database, and that database is developed from you filling out a form on our site that says to register for that. Now, if you have not registered yet, then it's a little too late for tonight's drawing, but make sure you do it for the next show so you don't miss out on some of the great prizes that we give out. Now, if you are the lucky winner, we will contact you after the show, provide you with the information on how to receive your gift. So the first one we're going to give away is the 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. If you want to learn more about the Federation, and that's an organization that just awarded Davey his award recently, the Federation of Fly Fishers, you can learn more about them at fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And the winner of that is Dave Bauer in California, Dave Bauer in California. So congratulations, Dave. If you've already got a membership, we'll extend it. If not, we'll get you started. So I know you'll enjoy it. Now, to give away our 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, another great magazine out of Calgary, Canada, that's making its way down to the States here rather quickly, is www.flyfusionmag.com to find out more about them, flyfusionmag.com. And the winner of that 1-year subscription is Bob Zagar in Missouri. Bob Zagar in Missouri. So congratulations, Bob. I know you'll enjoy that subscription as well. And then finally, we have Davey's DVD, Wet Fly Ways, which if you're going to try wet fly fishing, I don't see how you can even begin to start without this DVD. So let's see. Need to ask a question tonight. And I think the question's going to be, I'll keep it pretty simple tonight. What knot does Davey use to tie his droppers on in his leader system? What knot does he use to tie his droppers on? Now, Davey, that's pretty easy, isn't it?
Hey, I would say so, yes. Yeah.
But we got a winner right away, I think. Dan Sullivan in Grand Junction, Colorado says surgeon's knot. Is he correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. All right. So, Dan Sullivan, congratulations. Send me your address, phone number, email address, and so forth, all your contact information. You can either do it online in that same text box that you just submitted the answer to, or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. And I'll get that information to Davey, and Davey will send that DVD out to you, and I know you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, with pleasure.
Yeah, and everybody look forward to Davey's next DVD on the tying of the wet flies. I think that's going to be great. Well, thanks, Davey, so much for being with us tonight. Looks like we got through the storm, huh?
Well, it just started.
Can
I just make a quick comment here, Roger? I looked at the questions, you know, that some, and I really wish I could have answered more than we actually got here, but
yeah.
There's a friend of mine, he asks, how could he get rid of a load of big catfish in his pond?
Yeah.
And I'm going to give him the answer. First of all, get him educated feeding on the surface with pellets, and then get a shotgun and shoot him. Because there's a lot easier messing around than a fishing rod, I can tell you.
Yeah, I figured he was one of your close friends when I saw
that.
Yeah,
he is.
But, well, I'm sure you can go help him out, but just send the catfish fillets, less the BBs, over to my house, and I'll be glad to.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us again, Davey. I know it's been great. And if you want to hear Davey talk about the White River, we also have a show in our archive on the White River, so you can hear about that.
We'll have to get back there and do another wet fly one, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Lots to cover. Well,
yeah.
Our next broadcast will be on October 21st at 7 p.m. Mountain and 9 p.m. Eastern, and that show will be with Barry Reynolds. And our topic for the show will be tactics for monster carp. Barry Reynolds has a knack for catching big fish, and carp are no exception. Listen in and find out the tactics that Barry uses to hook into these monster carp. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Women's Fly Fishing, and Père Marquette River Lodge for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options to you. Again, that's 888-961-1115, extension 2. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.